Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, June 21st, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with our colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And joining us later will be Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner will speak with Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Haley Fager from WCAI. And now a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the island. Cindy, let's start this week with a report that looks at the costs to coastal communities that will have to deal with sea level rise. This is a national report, but it does single out Barnstable County.
Yeah, it's a big price tag for Cape Cod. This is a teleconference that our reporter Doug Fraser participated in on Tuesday. Now, the Center for Climate Integrity says that the cost to the nation for the cost to coastal communities dealing with climate change is going to be about $400 billion over the next two decades. But Barnstable County will be the highest in Massachusetts and the third nationally and will spend an estimated $7 billion to protect its public infrastructure. And this is to protect it from the impact of sea level rise.
Now, the state has been moving to try to address some of this.
Yeah, Governor Charlie Baker has proposed a real estate transfer tax. But, you know, it's interesting. The former regional director of the Environmental Protection Agency for New England, Curtis Spaulding, said that it will barely scratch the surface because it'll just raise about $1 billion over the next 10 years, which sounds like a lot of money, but is not, you know, that would have to be like $3.5 billion over the next 10 years to combat the effects that they've estimated will cost.
Other states also have been looking at this, but it seems like Massachusetts is kind of on the forefront of this with California.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because here you know, Cape Cod is actually like sticking out into the ocean. So, you know, you think that would be like, you know, a no-brainer. But it's actually because of regions such as the Northeast could see higher sea level rise because of a slowdown and a major current that transports cold water from Canada along the East Coast. And the Cape has already experienced 11 inches of sea rise since 1922. And that's according to Greg Berman of Woods Hole Sea Grant.
A lot of the cost here is looking at trying to protect buildings and infrastructure.
Yeah, and roadways, and they call it armoring the coastline. Now, Greg Berman said he thought that the $7 billion price tag actually sounded kind of high. And he said, but overall, he said the report is accurate. He said it'll be very expensive to protect the coastline against the impact of sea level rise. And this is, Cape has 560 miles of coastline, and it will, and this money is looking at protecting 404 miles of it that's very vulnerable to exposure from sea level rise.
And there are some actual numbers about what we could be looking at here. It says that there's a chance that it could be 4 feet over the next 50 years.
Yeah, there are different estimates. I mean, Massachusetts recently estimated there was an almost 100% chance that sea level rise by 2100 would not exceed 10 feet, and 85% chance it would not exceed 4 feet. Now, the estimate for 2050 was 1.5 to 3 feet, but that's significant.
So $400 billion, the overall price tag, that is a very big price tag for the country and a big price tag that the state is looking at eventually to figure out how to protect us as sea level rise.
Right. And people from the Center for Climate Integrity are saying, during this conference, people were saying, you know, we really can't like count possibly on that much from the state and from the federal government. I mean, already that there's been, you know, a backup of funds to assist people in Norfolk, Virginia, whose homes have been flooded. The people in the conference said that they could be waiting, you know, over 100 years for their reimbursement for their homes to help pay for the flood damage. And also, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers already has a backlog of $98 billion in projects nationally. So, yeah, that's significant. So who's going to pony up and help here is the big question.
Let's continue our climate change theme here. The Cape's local airline made an announcement that put it at the forefront of commercial aviation. Cape Air says it intends to purchase all electric planes as it's moving to replace its fleet.
Well, there's an organization called Aviation Aircraft, and at the Paris Air Show, they unveiled a prototype of an electric aircraft and announced that Cape Air would be its first customer. It's a pretty cool-looking plane. We ran photos in the paper. It looks like something out of the Jetsons. It's smooth and sleek, kind of almost pod-like. It's got these rounded windows high up on the body. Now, Aviation is an Israeli startup, and they said that they picked Cape Air because of its root structure.
Cape Air has about 98 planes, I think, in its fleet now. It really flies more than just to the, you know, between Hyannis and the islands. It's quite a big operation.
Yeah, yeah, and it actually has overseas operations as well. Now, this aircraft is, they're calling it Alice, and it will carry 9 passengers and fly 240 knots and can fly 650 miles on a single charge.
It's going to take a little bit of work for Cape Air to make this kind of a switchover from jet fuel powered planes that they have now to electric power planes.
Yeah, Aviation said that they would like to see the plane roll out for commercial use in 2022. But Daniel Wolf, he's the founder and CEO of Cape Air, said they'd really have to, you know, it'll take a few more years to get the infrastructure up and running. He doesn't see it happening until 2023 or 2024, that they have to put in charging stations and you know, really kind of change the infrastructure and have mechanics who can work on these planes, who are trained to work on these planes. One good thing for people who live near Barnstaple Municipal Airport and other airports that use Cape Air is that these planes will be very quiet.
Very quiet. And Dan Wolf, very excited that at the prospect of having these planes that they could charge. There's a big solar field right out at Barnstaple Municipal Airport. And then also talking about how Vineyard Wind will be setting up and the idea that we could have planes that are essentially emission-free. They're taking this electricity that's being generated by solar fields and offshore wind and flying you back and forth.
That is like something out of the Jetsons. It'll be less expensive for the, maybe ultimately less expensive for the customers.
Time frame here when we might see these planes?
So, and that would be like 2023 or 2024 for Cape Air.
So still three to 5 years out.
Right, right.
At the soonest. It's still an exciting prospect. I think a lot of people were really charmed by this story and the idea that it could be happening right here.
That it could be happening, right.
The Steamship Authority held a public meeting this week as it's looking to move ahead on a new ferry terminal. The community not so happy with the process so far.
Yeah, there's still a lot of lingering unhappiness with this. And this was Tuesday at Falmouth High School. About 100 people showed up, and the Steamship Authority had this. They talked about plans for their new ferry terminal design right here in Woods Hole. And some of the complaints are still that the building is too big and too tall, and people especially dislike the fact that it blocks the iconic view of Little Harbor from the Crane Street Bridge. And they're also concerned. Some people said that they just feel like the Steamship Authority isn't listening to them. They're not listening to the community with its concerns about the architecture and also about these trucks that are rumbling as they're trying to sleep, you know, down Woods Hole Avenue at all hours.
So this was a special meeting at the Falmouth High School this week and really drew quite a crowd.
Yeah, there were about 100 people there. And Robert Jones, he's the chairman of the Steamship Authority Governing Board, said it really bothers him, though, that people think the authority doesn't care. He said the board members read every one of 130 emailed public comments that were submitted in reaction to a trio of terminal designs that were unveiled in March.
Tell us a little bit about this has been an ongoing process for a while here.
Yeah, it's been an ongoing process. And some people, another thing another resident objected to was that Ted Fitzel said that he said that they didn't, Woods Hole villagers did not expect to have this big terminal built down here right on the waterfront. He said that 6 or 7 years ago, the Steamship Authority said the large building would go up on Palmer Avenue, and there would be a smaller building on the waterfront. And he said, you don't listen to us. Now, Catherine Wilson, she's a Falmouth representative on the Steamship Authority Board, said the issue is the busyness of the terminal. And this is basically a little quaint New England village. She said it has about just 1,000 people who live here year-round. In the summer, you're moving 2 million people in and out. And she does think that the building should be smaller, but she said the Woods Hole location is probably the safest spot. Now, Moira Tierney, she's the New England, the New Bedford representative to the Steamship Authority Board, said there's an elephant in the room. And she said, and that is that she believes that some Woods Hole residents just don't want the Steamship Authority in their midst, period. End of story.
What was the final takeaway from this meeting?
Well, you know, the Steamship Authority board member said the new terminals must be built and the time for decisions is running short. But interestingly, the board members decided to defer a planned vote on a set of architectural guidelines. And so that's something that still has to be hammered out. So there's a little bit of a it looks like a little bit of a brakes put on, even though they said the time is short. And it does have to have a flood-proof elevation of 17 feet because of the sea level rise.
Sea level rise. Here we are again.
Yes. Continuing theme, continuing thread here.
Let's talk about sharks now. Shark researcher Greg Skomel is spearheading a new study that's hoping to understand better how great white sharks make decisions as they're swimming along the Cape. Ultimately, the goal here is to help make it safer for folks who are sharing the same waters with these sharks.
Right, exactly. If you can better understand this predator-prey relationship between great white sharks and seals, then you can, you can minimize chances of encounters. That's the hope. That's the goal. And so they want to be able to find out, get a better idea of where the sharks are most likely to be found, and when they are most likely to attack. And Greg Skomel said that he's worked for years on a shark population study, and they're crunching the numbers on it right now on this 5-year study. But he said right now, when they started this study, it was the sharks were kind of situated out by Chatham near the seal colony, where there are tons and tons of seals, but very few swimmers. But now there have been these encounters. The young man killed in Wellfleet this summer, and a doctor from New York badly injured in Truro. So now it's about trying to minimize these encounters. And there, it looks like they want to use some interesting technology. This is technology that the State Division of Marine Fisheries has used for other fish species. And what they want to do is set out a grid of 20 acoustic receivers that will be attached to buoys. And these will record signals broadcast by the tags. And that the Skomel crew is already attached to more than 150 great whites. They'll be located about 300 to 600 feet apart, so they'll have this overlapping coverage area. And then a computer program will assess the relative strength of the signal between at least three buoys, well, triangulation, and they'll be able to tell the shark location to within about 3 feet, and they'll get lots of information, and they'll have data pressure sensor on the shark acoustic tag that will help determine the depth of the shark is swimming at, and something called an accelerometer measure.
Accelerometer,
that will determine the swimming speed and body position of the shark. So what this will create will be a 3D portrait of each shark within this grid. So you'll be able to see how fast it's swimming, how deep it's swimming, where it's swimming, and really get a picture of what the shark is up to.
And ultimately, he says they want to know about how they're feeding and where how they move as they're starting to feed and at what times.
Yeah, and how sharks use channels and sandbars, and how they move from the deep water into the shallow water, because we know they come into this very shallow water. They're giant, giant fish, and they come into this very shallow water. As a matter of fact, some of them have been found beached, and it's presumed that they were hunting seals and got couldn't get back out. So, but how do they get to shallow waters? What are the navigational paths that they use? They'll also be looking at water temperature, time of day, and tides, and more, so that they can get a picture of when the sharks are out and about, because right now it's a bit of a mystery. We know that they're after the seals, but there was belief a lot of predators hunt in the morning and the evening, but this young man was killed in the middle of the day. So we definitely need to learn more about the shark behavior.
Where are they thinking to set up these new round of study buoys?
Well, they haven't determined the location yet, but they're interested in Head of the Meadow and Long Nook Beaches and Truro and Newcomb Hollow and Wellfleet. That's where the fatal attack occurred in September. Also, Nauset Beach in Orleans is being considered.
Right now, this is the story as we head into the summer in some ways, is shark preparedness and what's going to happen this summer.
Right. And there are also shark researchers also added 20 new acoustic receivers that can record unique signals on the tags of more than 150 great whites. There are 8 new receivers between Provincetown and the Cape Cod Canal, and that makes a total of 14 receivers in Cape Cod Bay, because we now know that, sharks are in Cape Cod Bay. Used to be out there by Chatham. Now, they're just about everywhere. And the rest of the receivers are filling in gaps in the coverage area in the Outer Cape. And so there's a total of 50 receivers on the Cape, and that is 100 for the state. Including those, though, the 100 for the state includes some for striped bass research, because this whole system of setting up these grids and everything, that's used for other fish species, but now they're going to apply it to the great whites.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times has been Cindy McCormick. Cindy, thank you for coming in this morning.
You're welcome.
We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us on the phone right now is Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Noah.
Good morning, Steve.
Now, a legal decision this week has kind of reset the table for the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead Aquinnah as they're pursuing opening a gaming hall. Explain what's happened this week that really changed the game here.
So, this came in on Wednesday, and it was quite frankly pretty shocking or surprising news. Basically, what happened was a federal judge said that while the tribe absolutely has the right to build the facility, that's settled law. They have to abide by local building permits and other state and local regulatory laws before they can start construction. So this is pretty much a huge victory for the town. It might be a short-lived victory, but it's a huge victory for the town immediately because basically the tribe has been asserting since they cleared land back in February that they didn't have to abide by any sort of local permitting regulations, including the Martha's Vineyard Commission. And this definitely seems to say the exact opposite.
You say it was unexpected, but the town, it sounds like the town had really pushed to have this law applied here.
Absolutely. So basically the crux of the legal decision was that, this is complicated, so bear with me just a little. It goes back to 2015 when Judge Saylor, who is the judge who this case was heard in front of, he ruled against the tribe, saying that local gaming laws did apply and that they couldn't build the facility. Now, the tribe appealed that decision. It was overturned by an appellate court. And then the town tried to appeal that, but the Supreme Court denied cert or refused to hear the case. So what ended up happening was the tribe was granted the right to build the facility. And then Judge Saylor was asked to issue a final decision in the case that was in favor of the tribe. Now, Judge Saylor never issued the decision. So what the town did was they filed a motion asking Judge Saylor to issue his final decision that said, sure, the tribe has the right to build the facility, but they can't build it without these local regulatory permits, which would basically give the town the ability to kind of know what was happening with the casino or the project at all. The tribe has been pretty non-communicative with them about it. They've said, we don't need to tell you anything. We don't have to abide by any sort of local rules. And the town has said, no, you do.
And the tribe has already gotten underway with this project.
Right. So the tribe has already cleared 4 acres of land. Now, had this decision come out, or had they asked for final judgment come out, you know, way back in January before that happened, who knows what would have whether they would have been allowed to clear the land or not. But now the land is cleared. Construction has been halted since. The tribe has said publicly that wasn't because of the legal issue. The town has now, though, you know, they have some ground to stand on, at least, I think that's how they're seeing it.
And how much does this alter the timeline for the tribe as they were trying to get this up and running quickly?
Well, that's what we don't really know. Right now, they are not going to build or do anything, as far as I'm aware. We've requested comment, but not heard back from the tribe. I was just at the Martha's Vineyard Commission meeting last night where some commissioners discussed the issue, and they seemed very confident that the tribe wouldn't do any building until, at the minimum, they decided to appeal the decision. Now the tribe has 30 days to appeal. They can appeal, and pretty much all the signs are pointing toward them appealing. They've said that they would fight pretty much any legal action tooth and nail. So in the immediate future, though, it looks like things are on hold.
Can you explain a little bit what the apparent resistance to the tribe is to working with local permitting and regulation? Is it just a principle that this is their land?
It would seem that's pretty much the case. And I think tribal chairwoman Cheryl Andrews-Maltese has asserted from the beginning, at least from the beginning at this year, the Supreme Court granted us the right to build the facility. We're a sovereign nation. We can do what we want. And I think for a long time, there has been, I guess it would be appropriate to say that there has been tension between the town and the tribe about this facility. The town initially, the Town Homeowners Association was the one who brought the, legal action against the tribe back in 2015 when they were going to build it then. So the tribe thinks that there's a lot of kind of bad blood. They don't really want to have to abide by anything the town says, and they don't think that they should have to. And I think a lot of it is the principle, but a lot of it is also, a history of disagreement between the two sides, particularly about this issue.
And real briefly, just tell us what it is they're trying to build here. It's a bingo hall.
Yeah, so it's a Class II gaming facility. Now, I've actually never been in one, but from the research I've done and my understanding, these are electronic bingo-based games. So they're basically slot machines that function, though, on the principles of bingo. You have, like, a bingo card at the top, and then the slots will spin and give out numbers. So you kind of get, I guess, the experience of slots, but in reality, it's a little different than going to, you know, a casino in Vegas and playing slots. But yeah, it's gonna have. I think at least the plan that the tribe said was it was gonna have 250 games. It was gonna be 10,000 square feet and was gonna be this sort of tent-like structure, the sort of permanent tent that I guess could be comparable to like a tennis bubble or something of that variety.
Noah Asmo from the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us with that.
Thank you. Bye bye.
We are going to speak right now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, the town of Chatham is trying to curb illegal tree cutting. Explain what's going on here.
Sure. And recently, the town has been dealing with a spate of encroachment on town property. And as you said, most of that has involved tree cutting. And most of that has been at the edges of the town-owned Seaside Links golf course. There's been at least three cases documented where trees and brush were cut on golf course property. In most of those cases, it's been clear that that activity has been done to improve somebody's view. In just about all the cases, there's been no evidence that officials have been able to gather to pin the responsibility on a specific party, except one case where the town and a property owner were already in talks about removing some trees on town property, and through a miscommunication, the property owner's landscaper went ahead and cut the trees, and they're working on a restoration plan for that now. So that's sort of a unusual aspect of this, but in recent days, the town selectmen have been looking at a policy that would give them a bit more have more teeth to be able to go after some of these property owners. The board looked at this policy, which basically would give them some enforcement, would allow them to go after property owners for damages, which state law allows now, but they're looking at something a little more immediate that they could impose and set up restoration plans. If property owners don't cooperate under the policy, the town will go ahead and do it themselves and be able to go after the property owners. Selectmen were really adamant about doing something about this. They said that this sort of activity was unconscionable, and they likened it to vandalism. Town manager Jill Goldsmith had sent a letter to property owners around the golf course last year warning about this activity, and the officials say that they've found other encroachment on town land, including at a couple of the town cemeteries. In one case, someone built a shed on cemetery property. So the town seems really game to go after these people and really protect the town property, especially when it comes to illegal cutting of vegetation and trees, people trying to get a view, that kind of thing.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for checking in with us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
We're going to speak right now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Morning, Steve. Morning, Cindy.
Cindy actually had to leave, so it's you and me, Casey. That's what's going on.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Casey, an election in Provincetown this week with an unexpected outcome. Some of this has to do with financing a new police station and supporters of that move.
Yeah, this election on Tuesday was nothing if not surprising. The town leaders have been incredibly focused on passing supplemental funding for a new police station. They needed $3.9 million to reach the $12.5 million that was necessary in the latest bidding to get this police station built. And it actually seemed like an easy hurdle, this particular election, to get this money, since just 2 months ago, it passed with a majority vote at town meeting. The trouble was it actually needed a supermajority at that meeting on April 1st. So the select board decided they were just nine votes short on April 1. They would take it to the ballot again, where they thought it would certainly at least meet this bar to get the majority, and then they would bring it back to a special town meeting on June 24th. Well, big surprise, it actually failed at this election by 71 votes. The count was 400 to 471. So
you have a description in the article of when that vote tally was read, the response in the room.
Yep, that's right. Everyone gathered in the hallway of Town Hall for the election results. Everyone just said, wow, and then there was silence. It was a complete shock. So now this police station that has been a huge focus for the town is DOA on June 24th at the special town meeting. So, and luckily, kind of, if you can put it like that, the officials have run into another reason to even hold this special town meeting, which has to do with another project and supplemental funding for another project called Harbor Hill. But anyway, had this the entire point of the special town meeting next Monday would have been totally pointless if Harbor Hill didn't come up in the meantime. And the other big surprise about the selection was that Cheryl Andrews, one of the three candidates going for two seats on the board, she lost and was replaced by the chairman of the planning board, David Abramson. And it's unexpected because Andrews was the only select board member, one of the very few insiders at Town Hall, in fact, who was opposed to the police station. Both of her opponents who won strongly supported the supplemental funding for the police station.
So just to clarify here, the proposal for the police station financing failed, and the one select board member who was running who was against financing that, she wasn't elected back to the board. The supporters of the police station were elected to the board.
Exactly. So now we have no police station on the table, but a unanimous board that's in favor of a police station. So it's very strange, kind of hard to explain.
Well, that's why they hold elections, I guess, because you don't know what's going to happen. Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thanks for joining us and bringing us up to date on that.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
We are going to speak next with Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Brittany.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Brittany, the island's only licensed marijuana business, has been very quietly partnering with a big off-island business. Tell us about this.
Yeah, sure. So Patient-Centric is the island's first and only marijuana company. So we've been following their efforts closely for a while now. And they've acquired a medical marijuana license last year. They have a cultivation facility to grow medical marijuana. And as of recently, they're after a recreational license, which has gotten some mixed reviews from the town and town officials. So we've been following all that very closely. But two things came up this week that we didn't know before. And one is that Patient-Centric has ties to one of the largest marijuana companies in the country, Acreage Holdings, which has a market cap of $2.5 billion. So it's pretty massive. And the other thing we learned is that Patient-Centric is also pursuing a recreational license in the town of Framingham in central Massachusetts. So we're learning that our little island pot shop isn't entirely homegrown, and it'll be interesting to see how and if the community reacts to all of that. And another interesting bit is that Acreage Holdings was at the center of a Boston Globe spotlight investigation back in March, looking into big cannabis companies that may be in violation of the Massachusetts state law that prohibits marijuana companies from owning or controlling more than three licenses. And it's possible that Acreage Holdings is in violation of that, with ties to at least nine licenses, and both of Patient-Centric's Framingham Recreational Dispensary and West Tisbury's Medical Dispensary are listed among the nine. So it's interesting.
And what is Patient-Centric saying about this? Tell us.
Patient-Centric is saying that it's a private business matter. They don't need to disclose where they are getting their money because businesses borrow money all of the time. So they're not looking at it as something that they think they needed to put on the table before now.
What are some of the red flags that come up with this? I'm just wondering if somebody says, well, why does this matter, that this big Acreage Holdings is investing so heavily into the island marijuana business?
It's just a deep-pocketed investor, and it points to when Massachusetts legalized recreational marijuana, they did so with the intent to give the small entrepreneurs a chance. And knowing that big companies are backing these small entrepreneurs is sort of a loophole in the overall system. So patient-centric isn't in violation of anything, but interesting that they are tied to a business that could be in violation of something.
And the island, of course, also faces some very particular challenges when it comes to the marijuana business, because none of this can be transported across the water.
Right. Nothing can be transported across the water. So patient-centric has this cultivation site on the island where they're growing their own marijuana to dispense at the medical dispensary. But off-island, if they have a Framingham facility up and running, they will be able to potentially wholesale their product sourcing and use their partner, Acreage Holdings, to and sell the products that Acreage Holdings grows. So it's an interesting and unique position that patient-centric is in, working both on the island as well as on the mainland.
Brittany, I want to ask you about another story in the paper. It's about a popular island donut spot and home to perhaps the world's record-setting apple fritter. It's back in business with a new look. Tell us about this.
Yeah, sure. So we know that Backdoor Donuts is a beloved, longtime donut shop on the island. And last year, they were sold to three big-time business guys. And in their first years as owners, David Ginsberg, Patrick Lyons, and Richard Friedman changed nothing. But in their second season as owners, customers can expect a couple changes when they walk in the front door. The interior was completely gutted and redesigned, so there's new counters, new equipment, a self-serving coffee station, and there's brand new merchandise. And local architect Chuck Sullivan was behind the redesign. They also hired a new general manager, Kathy Kiley, to ensure everything runs smoothly, and they're trying to amp up the customer service so that people can go in, get their coffee, and get out. And they're trying to make that front door run smoothly. But the back door will ultimately remain the same because it's working just fine. But another interesting thing is that the front door was always known as Martha's Vineyard Gourmet Cafe and Bakery, but now they're changing the front door to be Backdoor Donuts. So it's Backdoor Donuts all the time, night and day.
Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brittany, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be checking in with news from the State House. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to update you now with action up at the State House in Boston. Things got a little heated there this week when lawmakers heard a bill proposing to expand abortion access in Massachusetts. It's in response to anticipated changes at the federal level. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with our State House reporter Mike Dean for a recap.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
So this was a big story this week with advocates from both sides of the abortion issue making their presence known on Beacon Hill for a hearing. How did that hearing go?
Yeah, Monday, really a lot of crowds were attracted to the State House. They filled both the largest auditorium in the State House and two different overflow rooms. The anti-abortion protesters had a rally out front of the State House. The rally was kind of a coalescing of a lot of the pro-life groups in and around Massachusetts, so they were definitely out in force prior to this big hearing, and it was a marathon hearing. And, you know, all sides were heard. There's an awful lot of, medical explanation and jargon and really, you know, testimony from physicians. A lot of the advocates and the opponents of this bill are kind of using medical language to say that it is or is not a medically accurate, you know, portrayal of what these procedures would be like. So, yeah, it was a long slog on Monday.
Remind us about the bill itself. It's on the table at the State House because abortion rights advocates are anticipating that the Supreme Court might overturn Roe v. Wade on the federal level. But the Massachusetts bill goes a few steps further and kind of adds some things in.
Mm-hmm. To boil it down to kind of three main points, this bill would codify a lot of procedures that happen here already that basically the lawyers want to see written directly into law, that, you know, instead of relying on court decisions. Another part is that it would do away with parental consent for minors seeking an abortion. Right now, either parents or a judge need to sign off on the procedure if you're under 18. And then the third big part here is that it would expand access to an abortion after 24 weeks of pregnancy in the instance of a lethal fetal anomaly. That is a birth defect that is diagnosed as to leading to the death of the child outside of the womb. And so that is another exception that they want to add to our existing abortion laws.
Now, with those who are opposed to this, is it that they don't want to codify abortion, you know, in general here in Massachusetts, or are the majority of folks who are on Beacon Hill this week and protesting this upset about some of the expansions or some of these new pieces that you were just talking about?
The pro-life crowd that was protesting out front, a lot of religious viewpoints and what you would expect, at least from like a national angle of what a pro-life argument would be. But that's not necessarily what is on the minds of a lot of lawmakers. I think if you are looking at the men and women who are going to be asked to vote on this, it's really the parental consent aspect that is most troubling. If you are a moderate Democrat who might be on the bubble about this kind of a thing, the parental consent angle is what they're most concerned about. I think there is an effort to very much specify that fatal birth defect part of the bill to just make it that small exception to the existing 24-week law. But what I'm hearing here is that the parental notification part of the bill is what is probably proving the most controversial.
Does that mean the bill will stall? I mean, you and I have talked about how the legislature, especially in the House under Speaker Robert DeLeo, if there's not, you know, almost near unanimous approval for something, that things can kind of just wither away or they'll avoid taking a vote on something controversial.
Mm-hmm. And this is probably one of the biggest maybes in state politics right now is, will this thing actually get to a vote? Right now, it is very much in the committee process, and it's going to have to be a compromise bill. And based on the testimony that everyone heard on Monday, there's a lot of what many people would consider improvements to this bill. Improvements in the sense that it could lead to it passing more easily. And like you said, Speaker DeLeo does prefer to have a very, very wide margin for these votes. He does not like close calls. They very rarely ever come up. And if you don't get that kind of accord early on, then you probably won't see a vote on a bill like this, and it will come back next session.
I imagine political analysts within the pro-abortion side of this issue know this, right? So does that mean that they're going to be willing to negotiate? Because, you know, I'm curious to know what the impact would be if the bill just stalls out and then we do see the Supreme Court overturn Roe v. Wade, what the impacts would be here in Massachusetts.
Right. And that is something that could give this a kick of urgency if something were to happen to Roe versus Wade, or, you know, a change on the court, something like that. Then it would probably change a lot of people's minds about how important it is to get it done. I don't think that there's really, it's not necessarily a sense of philosophy so much as it is a sense of urgency. And you know, a change at the federal level would certainly add that urgency. But I've talked with some of the proponents, especially on the House side, who say that there is room to improve the bill in that committee process of rewriting the bill to satisfy certain parties. Will make it a better bill. And I asked, does that mean it's going to be better from the advocate's point of view or better because it will become law? And I think it really is the latter. It's going to, you know, they want it to become law. They want it to codify a lot of these things that are in law. And they may negotiate things away. I wouldn't be surprised if the parental notification bit didn't find its way into state law this time. And maybe that comes back next session, or, you know, later on after something like this happens, because that isn't as necessarily attached to the federal issues the way some of the rest of the bill is.
I want to switch gears and talk about what's been big news in Boston recently, but it has implications for us across the state as we taxpayers all pay into it. And what am I talking about? The MBTA. Things have not been going well. There's been delays, a derailment, and growing calls for some big fixes. The MBTA board met this week. Did they address any of this stuff?
Yeah, the general manager of the MBTA did. He's been giving Steve Poftak, who's been about 6 months, maybe not a little bit more, has been the boss of the MBTA. And he did basically apologize to riders for what they're going through. I think a lot of riders, not just in the Red Line areas, it's the entire South Shore commuter rail as well, is taking a hit when the Red Line is down. So that is something that a large portion of the state is having to feel, and employers are feeling it because their employees aren't showing up for work on time. So, yeah, and when it comes to who's going to pay for it, everybody is, because, you know, those sales taxes, gas taxes, they all go to a portion of those go to the MBTA. And everyone suspects that if there is a funding fix in the works for the T, it's going to rely on those types of broad based taxes beyond just, you know, the fares that the T itself produces. So, you know, stay tuned. Like all things, there'll be a revenue conversation down the line. And we'll talk about taxes when they get to it.
I think it's interesting that this is happening as the State Transportation Department announced it would spend $18 billion over 5 years to try to modernize the T and address some of these bigger issues. And that also, speaking of the commuter rail, includes some money to expand the commuter rail from Boston on the down the South Coast to New Bedford and Fall River, which has long been talked about and is fraught with its own problems. But when you hear the news about what's happening on the T, you know, $18 billion doesn't exactly sound like enough.
The $18 billion is a long-term plan. That's really what Baker has been planning all along. He wants that amount of money to go into these types of projects. The South Coast Rail may seem counterintuitive. A lot of folks say, why aren't we fixing what we already have instead of expanding? But this has been long promised to commuters in, you know, Fall River, New Bedford area to get these trains running that far south. And if you are looking at the issue of highway congestion, if I'm sure plenty of Cape residents have had the misfortune of being on 93 trying to come north for various reasons. If the idea behind this being, if there are more trains and more people on those trains going into Boston, there'll be fewer on the roads, and it will help congestion. It's kind of two parts of the same coin here. And that also, that was a campaign promise of Charlie Baker dating back to 2014, that he would get commuter rail service to the South Coast. So that, you know, it's all one giant puzzle of transit and where people are, and transportation is housing, and housing is education, and, you know,
right.
state governments. But the South Coast Rail bit is one of the major pieces of Baker's plan that will hopefully be able to try to combat that highway congestion going forward.
That is WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking to us from our Beacon Hill studio. Mike, thanks so much, and we'll talk with you soon.
Great to be with you.
And that's WCAI's Catherine Iden, who spoke with our State House reporter Mike Dean. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. And joining us now in the studio is WCAI reporter and Morning Edition producer Haley Fager. Good morning, Haley.
Morning, Steve.
Haley, you got a plum story to cover this week, a very difficult assignment, to head to the island of Cuttyhunk to cover a special graduation. For anyone who doesn't know, first, tell us where Cuttyhunk is.
So Cuttyhunk is a tiny island, and it's only about a mile long and less than a mile wide, and it's the last in the Elizabeth Island chain, it's about 10 small islands southeast of the Cape, extending out from Falmouth. There's only a dozen year-round residents, and in order to get there, you first have to drive to New Bedford and then take a ferry. It's about an hour long, and that takes you to the island.
So this was all about a graduation. Tell us what was happening here.
It was. It was really exciting. Even on the ferry on the way over, as they were making the safety announcements, they made an announcement saying, "We're here to celebrate Gwen Lynch. Thanks, everyone, for coming out to Gwen." So that just kind of shows you what a big deal it was.
And Gwen Lynch was the graduate. The yes. graduating class, I should say. She was the entire graduating class.
Lynch was the only student graduating from eighth grade from a one-room schoolhouse, and she was the only student in the entire school, actually. And her dad, Dwayne, actually graduated from Cuddy Hunk Elementary School 35 years ago. And her brother, Carter, was at the school with her last year, but there's no other school on the island, so now he's at boarding school. So she's the only one.
So she was graduating eighth grade, the last student. And what happens, what's going to happen with her now?
Well, now she is going to boarding school also. She's going to boarding school in New Hampshire, and there are no more students in the school. So it's kind of a bittersweet moment for the island. It was, you know, I think it's kind of when there's only one student, it's you still have the community aspect of what a school brings. You know, you have all of the benefits to a community that come with a school. But if you think about it, you know, when there's a science fair or a school play or anything like that, this one kid is the only person there to do those things. So she's putting on puppet shows for the entire town. And, you know, it's just that is so wild to think about. And then also to think about having that go away is kind of sad for the town. Yeah.
You spoke with Gwen and she was talking about she talked to you a little bit about some of the challenges of being the only student in this small town. Tell us this yeah. little island. Tell us about that.
She said that it was mean of her parents to raise her there.
It sounds idyllic to many people, right? But for her, this was not really.
Yeah, she describes herself as a people person, really, and she is really extroverted, and she really wants to be in a city eventually. She loves the island, and she loves, you know, everything that she does there, nature, like climbing trees, all that stuff, but she really feels like she's ready for some more social energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So small island, one student, already very sweet. But then one of the things that really lifted the profile of this story was the graduation speaker who came to the island for the event. Tell us about this.
Right. Actress and comedian Jenny Slate, who actually grew up in Massachusetts, and her boyfriend runs a writing workshop on Cuddy Hunk. And her speech was really all about Lynch. It was all about, you know, her aspirations and her goals and kind of praising her for her easy confidence and her way of walking through the world. It was really empowering and it was really touching, actually. It was really a personal speech.
Yeah, I think that it really captured so much attention because you think of this one person sort of embodying the whole school and reaching this graduation age, and then having a national figure like Jenny Slate, who's a very charming actor, come and deliver a one-person graduation speech. So a lot of you are not the only media there that day. There were a number of other media outlets covering this. And tell us what that was like for this little island to be a bit besieged by media.
Yeah, there were a lot of people were there. And there were a ton of community members there too. You know, the church was filled with people from Cuddy Hunk who visit on the summer, people who live there year round. But there were also a lot of media people. There were CBS News was there, and all of the local reporters mm-hmm. were there because it was just such a great little story about this one student. And I don't know, maybe you've had all the attention on you this whole time, and then it just, it's kind of the culmination of all
culmination,
that attention.
Yes.
Really wraps it up. But Gwen dealt with it so well. She's so confident, and she she seemed really relaxed about the whole thing. It was cool.
And I'll say this for your story, too. You reported it for the radio, and NPR Radio picked it up, played it nationally, played it a couple of times, and gave it great play on their NPR National e-newsletter. So it was really fun to see your reporting and our local reporting appearing on the big national stage that way.
Yeah, that was really fun. Yeah.
That's Haley Fager, our Morning Edition producer and reporter here at WCAI, and that's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guests. We had Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. We spoke with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Haley, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.